If Only, Edward Chadwick by Louis Buss. The scrutiny of the handwritten inscriptions found in a 1935 edition of the book Self-Realization, bought on eBay, takes the author on a journey of inspiration and expectation. Continued from May-June issue. Part 7. The Once and Future King. A few weeks ago, after an absence of 2 years, I set off for my second visit to the ashram, taking the book with me, although I wonder now whether it would be more accurate to say that after an absence of 75 years, the book set off for India once more and took me along as a sort of unwitting shepherd. In any case, I found myself returning to Arunachala, the rock against which my life has broken, which rises from the surrounding plains like the island of some tropical Prospero, jutting from a South Indian sea. How many other ships have split against this magic isle? No mariner through human life is safe from it. You may be sailing in peaceful waters anywhere in the world, when suddenly some enchanted tempest will rise up and drive you here. Once you have run aground against these fatal rocks, you will find yourself lost in a strange shadow land of allegorical visions and waking dreams. Although you may seem to escape and even resume your former life, you know that this itself is only one of the illusions of the isle, from which there can never be any return to the waking world. It is 60 years and more since Prospero himself was last seen here with his loincloth and his staff, but still the place lies deep under his spell. As soon as you step beneath the magic arch and enter his domain, some unearthly quiet comes upon you, a sort of inner hush. All around, you will see his spirits and creatures working diligently away, as if they hold their master in such awe that they don't dare to relax even after all these years. Perhaps they believe that he is not absent at all, but has merely used his powers to render himself invisible for a while. Then again, they know that he can assume any shape at will, and thus they can never be quite sure that he hasn't returned to oversee their work in the shape of a dog, a monkey, or a bird. Or perhaps they believe he has retreated to some giddy crag near the mountain peak to sit beneath that mythical tree of which he himself once told tales. From there, perhaps, he can see and direct all the doings of the isle. There he may sit for thousands of years before he chooses to return below and reveal himself again, sunk for millennia under the deepest of all charms, which is his own. The very trees here are reputed to be higher beings, saints and sages, who have taken refuge on the island in vegetable form to avoid the tragedy of human birth. Like Ariel, trapped inside his spine, they are perhaps waiting for Prospero to come and free them, willing to serve him for a while as spirits if he will only grant them ultimate release. Every beggar in every ditch may be an angel or a visiting deity, but all of them understand that this is Prospero's kingdom still. In the small cell where the magician used to sit each day on his sofa, working his enchantment by word or look, or by reciting from some book of spells, his victims still sit bewitched for hours at a time. Elsewhere, in a different sort of trance, they walk round and round his shrine, like so many somnambulists, unconsciously drawn to the spiritual access of their master's castle. Further afield, in ones and twos, they circumambulate the entire island, demonstrating that this is the magic pole of the globe itself, the source of the universal charm that sustains our impossible world. Day after day, and week after week, the routines of the magician's home continue exactly as they did when he was still alive, as if the whole place were nothing but some giant clock he wound up and left to run for centuries. Late each afternoon, his creatures and spirits gather together to chant his spells and call down the tropical dusk. By the time silence falls, the charm has worked and the island has vanished from view. Nothing of him that doth fade, but doth suffer a sea change into something rich and strange. Whether he lets them know it or not, all who pass beneath that archway become his creatures. Nothing can happen there except at his bidding, for every action there is his. We are all his creatures there. So, whatever illusions he may have allowed me to retain, Bhagavan was the one who arranged for that book to be taken to the ashram archive. I had heard of the building before, but had never known where it was. Now it materialized quite close to the main gate. Although it was in full view, I had never even noticed a building there before, so that it was as if the archive had been wearing an invisibility cloak, or had been conjured out of nothing, purely to allow me the coming visions. Bhagavan had delegated a party of three to escort the book to the archive on the last leg of a very long and slow round trip. Myself, my sister, and a devotee who was friends with Sri Ramani, the ashram archivist, who seemed the manifestation in flesh and blood of the enormous devotion that raised this extraordinary building. Inside, the most elaborate precautions have been taken to preserve the assembled treasures in a strictly controlled environment. For here we find the objects most intimately associated with Ramana Maharishi, his walking sticks and umbrellas, his binoculars and pencils, the razors that were used to shave him, and the surgical instruments that were used to perform the operations on his arm. It is impossible not to feel that, through the prolonged contact with him, these objects have been subjected to a sort of benign contamination. They have been irradiated at the spiritual equivalent of a nuclear core. Who knows what power they absorbed as they bathed in that light? Years afterwards, some inner Geiger counter still seems to go mad the moment you come near them. And if they are kept sealed away in that carefully controlled bunker, it is perhaps to stop that magic charge leaking out into the surrounding environment. Just as radioactive objects acquire the power to engender diseases, so those pens, umbrellas, and walking sticks may well, by exposure to Bhagavan, have acquired the power to cure them. Who can say what benefits might accrue to anyone brave enough to touch one of the exhibits in that little museum? Of course, we didn't dare to touch, but just looked around in awe. At a certain point, I asked Sri Ramani if, of all the assembled treasures there, he had a personal favorite. He promptly replied that with Bhagavan, Everything was precious. I admired the devotion behind his answer and can see that from a purely professional point of view, it is the ideal attitude for an archivist to take. All the same, I have to say that for me, if there was one treasure that set my inner Geiger counter clicking more wildly than all the others, it was Bhagavan's famous walking stick, the simple rounded one we see in so many pictures. If I was diagnosed with some tumor or incurable disease and was given the chance to touch one object in the archive, I would immediately reach out for that stick. For what could be more deeply invested with Prospero's power than his staff? Bhagavan may have used any number of pens and other everyday objects, but only that stick was really a part of him, even more so than his famous water pot. As about the only object we could really have been said to possess, it stands as a symbol of his perfect renunciation. All his physical frailty and spiritual might are there. That stick was at once the support of a doddery old man and the rod of God himself, as Murugunna so marvelously put it, tottering around on a mountain looking for souls to save. That stick appears in the archival films not only to support him as he staggers through the ashram, but also as the means of greeting a baby, playfully conferring some blessing we will never know. Yet it is the same stick that appears beneath his hand in those pictures from which he radiates an almost terrifying power, making you feel that if he had chosen then to strike the magic staff against the ground, the impact would have sent a fissure round the globe, swallowing skyscrapers, buses and trains like so many inconsequential toys. I know I am not alone in feeling that I have not so much discovered Ramana Maharshi as remembered him after many years of effort. That lean, unclad figure with his weight on one leg seems to be some sort of universal icon, buried deep in every human being, or perhaps in every living creature, only waiting for us to sink down and uncover him. And if there is one object buried deep in the universal subconscious with him, it is that walking stick. Why this should be, I cannot say. Perhaps every living creature draws some deep reassurance from that grandfatherly symbol of humility and frailty, whilst at the same time instinctively recognizing a stick as the most basic symbol of power. For whatever reason, that is how God has chosen to appear. But as Caliban knew, if you want to overthrow Prospero, breaking his magic staff across your knee is not enough. You have to burn his books, for without them, he hath not one spirit to command. Bhagavan's books and papers are kept in separate rooms. Sri Ramani allowed us to go in and gape at the cabinets which contain every surviving scrap on which he wrote in his own hand, right back to and including that famous note he left when he set off as a schoolboy for Arunachala. It is all there, sealed up in packets and safe behind glass. Since everything has now been scanned onto special DVDs that will survive 100 years, it is hard to see why any of those packets should ever be opened again. There could be no conceivable excuse for risking damage to the precious originals when it is so easy to view a perfect copy on a screen. Perhaps it was the idea of all the undisturbed years ahead that filled that tiny chamber with the hush of an enchanted sleep. A small device in the corner drew endless peaks and troughs on a roll of graph paper, recording each tiny variation in temperature or humidity, like a life support system monitoring the vital signs of a comatose patient. Here, more than anywhere else in the archive, I had the sense of intruding on some Arthurian slumber. If nobody would ever dare to open any of those packets again, what was really the point of keeping them at all? Standing there, one could almost imagine it was only because the true owner might at any moment come back for them, like the once and future king awakening in England's hour of need, calling for his armor and his sword. Concluded in the next issue.